I love scotch. 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 Scotch.
Yep. Have another whiskey.
If you'd like to speak to me in person, press 1. If you'd like to order drugs, press hash.
I had a gentleman in the crowd that was like, tell me how to drink Glenfiddich. And I was like, I will not do that.
Yep.
You drink Glenfiddich how you want to drink Glenfiddich.
Wear a cowboy hat in Los Angeles and look at the amount of looks you get.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. This is the most flamboyant city on earth. You wear a cowboy hat, people look at you like you are like an alien.
The Beatles came on and my mate picked me up on his shoulder. George Harrison is as close to me as that wall now. I went, all right, George, all right. And he went, cock. And that was the closest I ever came to the Beatles.
We have a whiskey while we...
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Cheers, long.
Cheers.
Welcome back to United States of Dramerica, and this is going to be an absolutely fascinating episode. We have a slightly different type of guest. I think it's our first South African guest. We've had athletes before, but never an endurance athlete. We haven't had a near-death experience, and although we have had a cancer survivor. So as you can tell, there's a lot happening here. So welcome to the podcast, Grant Lottering.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be on.
So I think let's get some whiskey started, because these conversations are going to be wide-ranging and meaningful and deep at various stages, as well as lighter and fun at other stages, which is exactly what whiskey drinking is all about. So obviously, as an athlete, I can't imagine that you have an enormous amount of whiskey with you, but what have you got in your hand tonight?
I have a Glencullen from Speyside. It's a single malt. It's not too bad.
Excellent.
I'm sitting in a hotel room in Glendora, busy training in the mountains. Having flown in from South Africa, it's it's not as though I've been able to bring my McLellan or De Morangi with, you know.
So. No, indeed. In fact, to be honest, given the sort of things you're trying to achieve this trip, if you had a full bar with you, I think we should all be you should all be worried. So at my end, I always try and pair my whiskey with a guest, and I was really struggling for this one because I don't have any South African whiskey and I don't have anything sort of cycling related. So I was trying to work out what to do, and it's the best I could come up with is obviously your South African, which is obviously your sports teams wear Springbok green. So I'm drinking an Irish whiskey called Green Spot, which is one of my favourites. So,
from Ireland, okay.
It's the best I could do. I mean, last week I had a guy on from the LA Dodgers and they play in blue and I drank Johnny Walker blue. So having a Springbok and talking and drinking Green Spot seems to be the best I can come up with. So cheers to you, Grant. Thank you for joining us.
Just you, Dan. Yeah, and, I got my Springbok colors 3 times, in fact. So the green is a good – yeah, the green goes well. So, cool.
Excellent. So, why don't we do this? Why don't we start at the beginning? So,
okay,
you're a young man growing up in beautiful South Africa, and you fall in love with cycling and work your way up into the national squad, and hence you get your – Springbok green. Tell me how you fell in love with cycling.
Yeah, I just saw a local race, all the pros, and I went to watch it. I was a 12-year-old boy. Back in those days, in the 80s, I'm giving my age away, cycling was not a very big sport in South Africa. It was still a fledgling sport. It's certainly not a sport recognized by schools as a school sport. But I loved it. I was absolutely intrigued. And one of the other reasons was that I knew early on in primary school already, I simply was not capable of running fast. Neither was I any good at anything that involved a ball. So I was, as far as sport goes, I had a bit of a problem at school. But then I discovered cycling, and I was so comfortable on a bike. And I just knew I was born to ride a bike. And it quickly became a sport, and I continued with it throughout school. And I was actually one of the youngest guys in the country to get my Springbok colors. I was 18 years old. I turned pro when I was 20. We were still banned in Europe at that stage due to our previous government, so I couldn't race in Europe until 89, and I went over. I was a 21-year-old, raced in Belgium and France. But yeah, we were still not completely open to race in Europe, and it became a problem. So I came back and gave up my sport. I had achieved everything I wanted to and started a career, but always continued cycling as a pastime.
So obviously I my father's South African, although it pains me enormously that I've never been there. But obviously I know it's a country with some very complicated political history, obviously some civil issues there of different type now. But it's also, and this is, everyone who's ever been there will always say, what a beautiful country it is. And obviously as a cyclist, you cover significant distances. I mean, as a kid, were you, I'm just trying to imagine, you know, is it sort of riding along past, you know, incredible mountains and amazing wildlife? Was it that, or is that a little bit idealistic for what cycling around South Africa looked like?
Well, it's not completely off. I grew up in the north of Johannesburg, which is up north in the country. It's just not the ideal place because you don't really have mountains up there. It's what we call the high veld. So we're at like 1,600 meters altitude. But there's a lot of reserves around there, small little game reserves and stuff. And I can, you know, I used to ride my bike past them and I would see the rhino and the lions and stuff behind the fences. So that was pretty cool. And that's like, that's about what, an hour and a half's drive outside of Johannesburg. So you still have that today, but I've since moved down to the most beautiful part of the country, which is the Winelands, the Cape Winelands, Stellenbosch, all those places. Where gin production is also taking off at a rapid rate of knots. But our wine, as you know, our wine is really world famous. And so now I am living in the mountains, and I can get to ride my bike in some of the most beautiful parts of the country.
Fantastic. You know?
But as a kid, I used to just ride through the neighborhoods and stuff. Unfortunately, our country is not geared for cycling. We don't really have cycling lanes and stuff. Back in South Africa, as a cyclist, you've got to give way to the motorists, unfortunately, not the other way around. So you've got to be careful where you ride your bike, you know. It's just one of those things.
Now, I am going to sort of, in some ways, the beginning of your story.
All right.
It begins with quite a significant crash. But before I ask you about that, I guess, given what you've just said, were you knocked off your bike often, either by other cyclists or cars? Did you have many accidents of any seriousness before the one that I guess sparked the rest of your life?
Touch wood, I've never been touched or hit by a car, which is wonderful. I'm very grateful for that. I've had many crashes. I mean, you're not a cyclist unless you crash, you know, but I've had plenty, but very seldom very serious. I would break my, you know, like my collarbone or my clavicle, that type of stuff, or a wrist or something stupid, but nothing ever serious enough to put my life in danger. But certainly the crash we're going to talk about now in 2013, that became the first day of my second life, you know, just totally. It just put my life totally on a different trajectory altogether.
Yeah. So tell me about that day on a mountainside in Italy and what happened, and then we can talk about what happened after that.
Yeah, it's quite strange. You know, looking back, there's actually some fond memories of that time, even as traumatic and painful it was. But there are some pretty good memories. I was in such an incredibly beautiful part of Italy. Trento was right at the base of the Italian-Austrian Alps. And, you know, it's just wildly popular for skiing in winter and all kinds of adventure sports in summer. And that's where the race took place that I crashed in. So a year before my accident, I qualified for the World Championships for my age group, which was 40 to 44. And it was going to take place in Italy in 2013. And I went 2 months ahead of the actual World Champs to prepare by riding a race on the same route, to get familiar with those mountains. I'd never ridden there before, and also to gauge my form and that. So this race started in Trento in the piazza, in the square, with a big Duomo, the big church, really beautiful setting. And We had about a 10K valley road outside of the town, and you know, we flew out of there. I mean, we were just going so fast. It was unbelievable. I mean, this big group of riders, all very well trained, all very, very skilled racing cyclists of different age groups. We were all together in one group. And then we got up the first mountain. It was about a 15K, call it a 7 mile climb, up over through a tiny little village, narrow roads, and then straight down the other side. And I remember we came around a corner, there was some water runoff, as it had rained the night before in the mountains. And we came through this corner, and pretty quickly I realized I don't have the right line. I was in a small group chasing the front guys. And I knew I was in trouble. But just before that corner, I remember looking at my computer on my bike, and I was doing over 40 miles an hour. We came through this corner. It was like a sweeping bend, not a very sharp one. So if you got the line right, you just went straight through it into the apex of the corner and out the other side, and you're good. I didn't. And I didn't make the corner, and there was a rock embankment in front of me. And everything just slowed down in that instant. I can just remember everything so clearly. I just thought to myself, Grant, do not hit your head. And I just turned my body to the left side, and with my right, I just crashed straight into the rock embankment. And I bounced back into the road, and I lay in a fetal position facing the guys coming down the mountain with my legs and that in the road. So I was half in the road. But I couldn't do anything. The pain was excruciating. I screamed. Blood was pouring out of my mouth. Another cyclist crashed into me. He didn't make the corner, or he couldn't avoid me, and he broke my femur. Wow, it was chaotic, man. A few other guys stopped to try and help. They could see it was serious. I could still hear the cyclists coming by and them yelling, trying to warn other cyclists coming around the corner. And, you know, the sound of a bicycle when it comes past you is like, whoosh, whoosh. And these guys just kept flying past me, and I was just lying there screaming in pain. I can remember it all because I didn't even scratch my helmet in the crash. I just took the full brunt with my body. And after a while, it was quite a miracle that the race referee, the official vehicle, was behind me. And in the car was the head of the ICU unit down in Trento. So he came over and he started working on me, and he called the ambulance. Air ambulance came through as well, because he could see pretty quickly it was serious. But at that stage, Dan, I could still remember everything. I was still conscious. Pain was just...
Hey? Was it normal for the ICU guy to be there on a race, or was he just there coincidentally? Because he wasn't there to do trauma surgery. Presumably it was... Is it a coincidence?
According to him, he came and spoke to me in the hospital thereafter, and he said to me it's the first time that he volunteered to go on the race, on the route itself, because it's actually a dangerous race. The mountains there are very steep, very fast, very narrow, very technical, and there's always a lot of crashes. And it was the first year that he was in the race official's car. So, yeah, it really was a miracle that he was there, because obviously he knew what to do. Yeah. But, I remember lying there, just screaming, trying to breathe. And so what actually happened was I took the impact with my right shoulder. I crushed my right shoulder completely. The specialist called it a floating shoulder, meaning everything that attaches your shoulder to your body was either torn or broken. My shoulder blade was totally fractured. My collarbone was shattered. My sternum I had a compound fracture in my sternum. I broke 12 ribs, 9 on the right, 3 on the left. They both punctured my lungs. Well, they punctured both my lungs. My thorax collapsed. My lower spine, I had 2 compound fractures in my lower spine, my right femur, my femur neck. I had internal bleeding, my abdomen, my spleen. It was just 22 fractures all in. And I got to a point where I couldn't feel the pain anymore. I remember it so clearly. It was so surreal. I was lying there looking at all these faces above me, all the chaos, and suddenly I felt no pain at all. And then I couldn't hear anything. And then my eyes, my vision started going blurry, and I realized I'm busy dying. And, you know, to give you an idea, when the surgeon spoke to me afterwards in hospital, he said they had to defibrillate me twice. And we've actually got footage of them trying to resuscitate me on the road, of a fellow competitor who stopped. He had a GoPro on his helmet. So the footage is on YouTube. It's on it's on my website, and it's quite graphic. And looking at it, I can see myself dying because I'm convulsing, and then nothing, no pulse, nothing. And they make the decision to defibrillate me. And that was the point where my sight just went and I realized I'm going to die. And I remember just thinking, God help me, I'm dying. And next thing, it was as though I was having a power nap then. It was just total peace, total silence, nothing. And I woke up 2 days later in ICU. And that was pretty traumatic in itself. But they defibrillated me on the road, and then they defibrillated me again in the helicopter on the way to the ICU unit.
Extraordinary. So
yeah, sure.
You wake up in an ICU, mm-hmm. you know, on the other side of the world, having yeah. been through all of that. Like what happens to you in those few hours after you wake up? What do you start thinking about?
Yeah, it was crazy. You know, I'm in a foreign hospital. And yeah, I remember coming around and, you know, I had a tube in my throat because I was on a ventilator, and they had sedated me. I had an epidural. You know, with all these, the compounding effect of all the fractures and everything, for 6 days they reserved to give a prognosis. That's how touch and go it was. But I came around and I remember I couldn't move. I could not move a thing. And I tried to call, but I couldn't, because you've got to, you know, when you have a tube in your throat, you cannot even clear your throat. You cannot make a sound. There's nothing you can do. And I'm lying there and started panicking because my first thought was, okay, you're in hospital, because I just see all these lights and stuff, and I'm thinking, I can't move. Am I paralyzed? Please let me not be paralyzed. And I started panicking. My heart rate went very high, and then the doctors came over. I can still remember that. And then I saw my brother next to the bed. He lives in Holland. And, you know, fortunately, when I raced, I had my travel insurance certificate in my pocket. I had a copy of my ID. I had a copy of my emergency contact in my pocket, who was my brother. So they had contacted him. He drove 10 hours through the night to get to my bedside the next day. So he was there, and I just looked at him, and then they sedated me, and I was out again for I don't know for how long. But when I came around after that, I was a bit more conscious of what's going on. And my brother just started talking to me. He held my hand, and he said to me, "You're okay, you know, you're not paralyzed, but you're very badly injured." And he just told me everything that's broken and what actually, you know, they already had done 3 surgeries on me in the ICU. And I was there for 9 days. And in that time, it was incredibly difficult then, because at first I was just really angry that it happened, because I trained for this race and now I'm not even going to get to do it, you know. But at the same time, I was so grateful to be alive mm. and not paralyzed. All I wanted to know was, will I get back on a bike again? You know, I suppose it's like these guys that race Grand Prix bikes, you know, they crash at 200 miles an hour and they get up and the first thing you want to do is get back on the bike.
Yeah.
So that's all I wanted to know. Will I ride again? And I'll never forget this. The one surgeon came over in ICU, he came over to me and my brother spoke to him, and he could speak English. And then my brother said to him, "Grant wants to know, will he ride a bike again?" And the doctor just shook his head. He said, "No." He said, "But we have a name for you. We're calling you Dead Man Walking." Yeah. I'll never forget that. Yeah. And he said to me, it's an absolute miracle that you're alive and that you are not paralyzed. We cannot explain it. So, yeah, then the gravity of the whole situation really hit me quite hard. Yeah, I spent 9 days in ICU. It's a bit surreal.
So when did you – because obviously, you know, fast forward a few years, you're doing these incredible endurance races. You're raising money for charity. You're talking about your journey. Mm-hmm. At what point did you realize that, you know, you should be doing something with this as you sort of second chance at life and that you could make a difference? I mean, this isn't obviously something you wake up to on the first day and decide you want to go and do it, not least because you were told you could never ride again. But, you know, was there an epiphany, or is this just over a period of time you realized there was a chance to do something special?
Yeah, it was quite remarkable, sort of like the little string of events that actually took place. I remember speaking with my brother once I took the tubes out of my throat. That was on the sixth day. I could start breathing with a normal ventilator, not a tube in my throat. And and I said to him, "So, brother, what am I going to do now? I can't ride a bike anymore." And he said to me, "Don't make decisions so quickly. Just leave it. Just get better." And I remember they transferred me from ICU to high care. And I was lying in my bed one night, and, you know, the pain was incredible. I mean, they were weaning me off morphine. It was – I couldn't sit up. I mean, most people know what it feels like to break a rib. I had 12 that was fractured, plus my back, plus my spine, plus my sternum, plus my – it was just crazy, the pain. But so I was awake most nights, and then I was lying there one evening, and this guy walks into the room. I could see he's a doctor. And he came and he introduced himself, and he said, "I'm Marco. I worked on you on the road. I was part of the team that saved your life." Yeah, and it was very emotional for me, and I just thanked him, you know. And he sat next to me, and he was there for about an hour, and we just spoke about what happened. And before he left, he said to me, you know, he explained to me everything that they did and what happened and how they got me to the helicopter, how they had to transfer me down the road to a place where the helicopter could land and all kinds of stuff. But then he said to me, "I'm the first patient he can tell this to, that I survived death." He said, because they lost me twice, and he was convinced that I had died. And next thing, my heart just started beating. Softly, it just started beating again in the helicopter. And he said to me, "You're alive. There's a reason you're alive, and it's up to you what you're going to do with it." And then he left. You know, it's almost like he was an angel sent into the room, spoke to me, gave me a bit of hope, and there he goes. Whoop, gone. Quite incredible. And that changed everything for me, you know, because up to that point, I was lying there, and all I could think about was what happened to me, the pain I'm in, and having almost like a pity party. And it was just overwhelming because they kept telling me, "You can't stay here forever, but we can't fly you anywhere. We can't drive you anywhere. We're going to have to work out how we're going to get you out of hospital eventually, but you're going to be here for a good couple of weeks still," and all this stuff. Yeah, and that night then after he left, I lay in bed and I just had a vision of a blank page. You know, I spent a lot of time praying. I believe in God, and you know, I think my faith played a major part in my recovery. But I just saw a blank page, and it's like, you got a clean slate, man. You know, you can start something new here. And I started making notes in my book. I had a little notebook my brother left with me. And I remember I wrote in there, "Grant, if you died, how would people have remembered you? How relevant was your life?" And I spent a lot of time thinking about it. I wasn't happy with the answers I found. So there I determined I want to come back and finish the race. I want to come back the next year. I still wrote it down. It was the 29th of July. I wrote it in the little book. 2013. I want to come back the next year, and I want to be relevant. I want to do something with my life. I'm going to use this. that was it. I just wrote it down. How that was going to happen, I had no idea.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how long was it before you got back on a bike?
Well, I was not in hiking for 12, an additional 12 days. And then in that time, I recovered so quickly. I mean, I just got so determined every day. I would just give myself these little goals just to sit upright. Eventually, they said, listen, we can fly you home with medical assistance. My travel insurance covered it in full. So I got home. I was at home for 4 months from work. I mean, I was in a wheelchair and I couldn't walk. I couldn't do anything. But I set myself a target. You know, I got home in August 2013. I had a target to start riding my bike on the 1st of February 2014.
Wow.
When I got home, I weighed 59 kilograms. My race weight is 69. So my muscles had completely degenerated. I received an additional 3 shoulder surgeries in that first 3 months that I was home. And every surgeon I spoke with said, you won't ride again. And I found one guy who said, Grant, you will ride again, but not next year. I said to him, I'll take that. Let's do what we have to do. But I started riding 1st of February 2014. And the longest ride I can do was 10 minutes. And I had to get off because of the pain.
And when you got back on the bike for the first time, were you – because obviously falling – off it again would not have been good for you. You know, were you nervous to get back on a bike? Or
I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. Just because of the severity of my injuries. And I was so far away from being in a position where I could actually ride a bike.
Yeah.
You know, my shoulder, my shoulder is so badly damaged. Even today, still, it's more than an inch narrower than the left shoulder, and I couldn't reach the handlebars properly when I started riding my bike, and my right leg had not recovered yet. I couldn't even touch my toes properly at that stage. But yeah, I was terrified. But you know, I had my friends with me, my cycling buddies, and we just went for a short ride through the neighborhood. I was terrified of falling off, absolutely. Yeah. But I chose not to go for counseling and all that stuff. I knew that once I get on the bike, psychologically, it will be a major victory for me.
Mm.
Just to know that I've ridden my bike again the first time, that I can do it. And you know, sometimes that's all we need to do is just give yourself that psychological breakthrough.
Yeah.
Like taking that first step, you know?
I mean, you know, it's one of those things. It's for both bikes and horses, they always say, you know, if you fall off, just get back on again. I don't think they normally mean it after a near-death experience, but I suppose it's the same principle applies.
Yeah, it is. I took a massive risk. I remember my surgeon said to me, Grant, if something happens to you, I take no responsibility and I will not have any sympathy for you. He told me I'm being very irresponsible when I said to him, I'm going back in July to finish the race. Now, the race I went back to try and finish is 170 kilometers in the Alps, up and down mountains. So, and one Feb, I couldn't ride more than 10 minutes, which was about 5 kilometers. Yeah, it was a massive, massive stretch. Massive
but you
risk.
Did it.
I did, eh? Yeah, I did. But I think part of what enabled me to do it was that I was so determined that physically I did everything I could, but I made sure mentally that I completed the ride even before I did it. So that's where I learned to harness the power of visualization and the effect it has on the effect that your mind can have on your body, because your mind controls your body, not the other way around. And every day, even though I looked in the mirror and I just saw this skinny guy with the right leg with hardly any muscles, and I ignored it. Every day I would just sit, make time and just sit and just visualize myself riding in the Alps, riding my bike, finishing the ride. I visualized it every single day. And that became my reality in a way, not what I saw or felt, but what I believed. And by the time I got to the race, I mean, I could still not carry a bag in my right arm, but I was on the start line, absolutely terrified. My brother was there again. He took photographs of me at the start. And I remember saying to him, my brother, Glenn, what was I thinking? What am I doing here? You know, and he said to me, Grant, this is your day. This is your day. And I just pictured myself finishing the ride. And I did. It took me over 8 hours, but I did.
Yeah, I was going to say, presumably you took the corners a bit more slowly this time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody was flying past me going downhill. I was looking for parking. I was so scared. I'm telling you, it was terrifying.
What was it like riding on the actual corner where the original crash happened?
My goodness. Yeah, it was, you know, it was less significant to me than the day before, because what I did do when I got to Italy the day before the race, and Glenn was there again, my brother, we got in the car and I said to him, I want to go to the point where I had the accident. I'd never been back there. And we went to the exact spot where I had the accident. And I remember I was crying. I was so emotional. And he parked the car and I said to him, just give me a bit of time. And I walked up to the place where I lay, took photographs of it. So we got like a before and a after situation. But I remember just spending time there, just sitting there. And I just sat there. I just thought to myself, you didn't get me this time. Tomorrow I'm going to come to Ostia. It's going to be the biggest victory of my life. And I found closure there, you know, sitting there right on the spot where I lay a year before. Yeah. Very emotional, but incredibly powerful. Mentally, that was a massive boost for me.
Extraordinary.
And I got up and I told my brother, come, brother, let's go. I'm ready. And the next day I came past that corner and I remember looking at the rock and I just repeated it. I just said, you didn't get me this time. That was it, Dan. That was it. Amazing. And I had a massive smile on my face. I'm telling you. I had a huge smile on my face.
I can imagine.
So, it was amazing.
So, look, I mean, this is an extraordinary story. I mean, let's talk about where we are today. So,
yeah,
obviously, you know, riding that first 10 minutes, doing the race again, all, you know, if the story stopped there, you could probably still make, you know, a Hollywood movie about it. But that wasn't enough for you. Now you're doing extreme riding that even people who hadn't had what you've been through would struggle to do. Just talk about these impossible tours that you do and the one that you're doing here in America at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So after that race, I remember crossing the line and both myself, and my brother, we hugged each other. I cried. The doctor was there. The media was there. And I said to him, Glenn, everyone said it's impossible. And I just proved it's possible. And he still said to me, this is your impossible. And I'll never forget that. And that night we were sitting celebrating. And I said to him, I'm going to come back. I want to do this again. But Glenn, I want to start pushing the envelope here. I'm going to ride further. And I already started working on this idea. I want to do a 24-hour ride through the Northern Alps in France. No one's done that under 24 hours. No, it's about 350 miles. And a year later, I did it. But yeah, so the tours, that's where it really started, in the Alps. And I remember I went to Laureus in South Africa and told him what happened to me and what I did. And I said, I want to be a fundraiser for you guys because you use sport to change children's lives. It changed mine. This is what happened to me and I'm going to raise money for you guys. And they said, great, we'll support you. And I started doing that. And I was still working full time at a bank in a consulting and actuarial division where I worked for 17 years, in fact. But my life just went on such a different trajectory being at work. I just didn't fit in there anymore. I just didn't want to be there anymore. I had this massive vision of doing these huge rides across the world, raising money for children, and sharing my story to people, inspiring people, you know. I had a vision of getting my book done, a documentary, doing celebrity rides with celebrity sports people, stuff like that. It's all things I'm working on. And it just started to unfold one year after the other. And every year I would ride further. Every year I would ride higher. I've done tours in France, in Italy, in South Africa, and now I'm going to do one here in the States. Yes, I've had 12 surgeries to date, so it's not been an easy journey, Dan. I've had to overcome a bout of cancer in 2016, another severe crash where I broke my left shoulder. So I've been up against it in this time, but it's all part of the journey, you know. No one said it's going to be easy. If you're going to step out and do stuff that you've never done before, it's not going to be easy. Because I've got this purpose behind what I do to really make a difference in people's lives and especially children's lives, that's what keeps me going. And so these tours, they're basically an enabler for me. It's the catalyst. I've got a talent to ride a bike, and I've always used it for myself. Now I'm using it for others. I'm using it for a different purpose. And it's just a natural progression. So UHSM, Healthshare, they heard about my story. They contacted me, and because I'm a Christian, they're a Christian-based company. They invited me to come over and do a tour here, and they'll sponsor it. They'll support it. So I'm here now to do another big tour. And, yeah, it's just an absolute privilege. I've shared my story in 12 countries to date. Travel all over the world, just telling people what you can do when you have a clear vision and a purpose, and just a refusal to give up, man. You know.
So, where are you going to be riding across America?
Yeah. So, I'm excited. I've been here almost a month. I've done a full route reconnaissance. I'm in California. I've been based largely down in Santa Ana. I'm now up here in the San Gabriel Mountains. I'm heading up towards the Sierra Forests near just south of Yosemite to go and train at altitude because that's where my tour is going to start. Dan, I'm going to start on the 1st of June in Shaver Lake. Then I'm going to head up around Kaiser Pass and then down, and then I'm going to go through Sequoia Forest all the way down across to Santa Barbara. And I'm going to ride all the famous mountains. So I've basically got a route which is about 720 miles. And between Shaver Lake and Irvine, where I want to finish, down near Santa Ana, I'm trying to cover just about, ride over just about every mountain I can find in between.
And this is without stopping?
Yeah, I do these tours without stopping. Well, I will stop and have a nap for 20 minutes. After about a day, I start napping because I'm going to be riding probably between 60 and 70 hours continuously. So at some point I'm going to have to nap. I can generally go about 48 hours without sleeping at all, but then you start hallucinating and it becomes dangerous on the bike. So I tend to just pull over and have a nap next to the road somewhere. I do have support cars. I do have a support team, but I get on the bike and I just keep going, and I try and do it in the fastest time possible. That's the one challenge with this. The second one is, I do ride over mountains, and the reason for that is that's the way we raise money on my tours. We basically get corporates to donate to Laureus by way of buying a mountain, if we can call it that. So I'll be going up Gibraltar Road. We want to get corporates to donate $2,000 for Gibraltar Road, and then, you know, we're going to give them a nice photograph to summit the memento. Thanks for supporting and sponsoring Gibraltar Road. That type of thing, and it's been very successful worldwide for me in terms of how I raise money. Yeah, and also, you know, mountains are illustrative, and it represents mountains people face in life. I faced a massive mountain. I got over it. So it's all part of the story, you know.
So, I mean, obviously, I remember reading a book about an endurance runner who would do, you know, they'd run through the night and get pizza delivered to wherever they were running and sort of eat it while still running. And, you know, and the guy was talking about being addicted to, you know, he run 100 miles and then he went, right, I want to do 150 next. And what part of this are you, I guess, effectively addicted to? Is it the fundraising? Is it telling the story? Is it the actual riding? Is it, you know, part of your faith? No sane person can do all of this. There must be something specific that's driving you.
Oh, man, that is such a good question. I really like the way you put it. You know, what's really driving me is just the gratitude that I have that I can still ride a bike, that I'm alive. You know, I'm 53 years old, Dan. Most people don't believe it. I don't. On the bike especially, people think I'm 35. You know, I look like a pro on a bike. And I think it's because of my faith, absolutely, but it's also, I'm addicted to it in the sense that the sense of accomplishment I get from doing these rides, it's just, you cannot describe it, you know, while you're in it. I mean, the pain really does become excruciating. I mean, my shoulder really becomes a problem. It really gets tough on the bike, but you live in the moment and you really just enjoy every second. And when it's over, it's almost like disappointing that it's over. So I've become a bit addicted to the pain that goes with it, if I can put it that way. But it's weird.
Your poor brother who drove through the night after presumably getting some kind of panicked phone call from an Italian hospital. And, he made the mistake of giving you a notepad for you to start visualizing your ideas. And now he's sort of supporting you on this. What do people like him and others close to you think of all of this? Is there a point where, does everyone understand why you're doing it? Or are some of the people saying, enough, Grant?
Yeah, it's quite strange. I often get the question why, especially when we send out the media releases about the tour, and then the response we get is always, when I get interviews, it's always like, so why that? Why this? Why still ride your bike after everything that happened to you? And people just don't understand when you've got it's I think it's destiny, when you've got something in your heart, in your gut, and you just know it's what you're supposed to be doing. And you have a purpose behind it, it makes it so much easier for you to do it. So it might sound to people, it might sound absolutely impossible to many people to think I'm going to be riding through the national forests, through Santa Barbara, through Ventura, through LA County, all the way down to Irvine. For a lot of people, it seems impossible, but for me, it's not. It's just, it's what makes me tick. And while I can still do it, I'm going to keep doing it. I think I can still do it for a good few years. And it's just the absolute sense of gratitude I get afterwards, knowing what I've done has made a difference, and that people respect it, people appreciate it. So I'm definitely not doing it to get the accolades or the recognition. Not at all. I'm not doing it to try and be the guy who rides the furthest or the highest. I'm doing it because I want to show people that you can live your best life, that you've got to live your life. Don't let your life live you. And if it means you've got to do stuff that other people think is crazy or insane, so be it. Don't let other people put their limits on you, So
I can't think of a better way of phrasing this question, so I'll just phrase it like this. Are you glad you nearly died on a mountainside in Italy?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Because, my life has been tough since, but it's been absolutely incredible. I would have never, ever in my life thought that I would be where I am now, that I would have traveled the way I have, that I would have met the people that I have, that I would have done what I have. I see it as something that happened for me, not to me.
Yeah.
So I'm glad, but I'm equally grateful. Absolutely. I wouldn't have it any other way, for sure.
Now, look, this is such a fascinating conversation. I would love actually to do a 48-hour continuous podcast with you, with just occasional stops for 20-minute naps so we don't hallucinate. But unfortunately, that's not how podcasting works. So I'm going to have to move to the final question, which we ask every guest, which is, and I can't wait to hear this answer from you, given everything that you've talked about in your life. If you could drink any whiskey with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be? What would it be, and where would it be?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, man. Whew. Well, I know who I would want to drink it with. That'll be Greg LeMond.
Okay.
You know who that is, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he also pretty much died, and he had a major comeback and won the Tour de France twice after he got shot in the back with a shotgun. I would love to sit with Greg LeMond, have a whiskey with him. In his house. He lives out in Tennessee now. No, not in his hands. No, no. If I could pick a place, I mean, whiskey, yeah. I mean, it's got to be in Scotland somewhere, you know. I can't think of a particular place. What would it be? Well, you know, I had a McLellan not so long ago. And my goodness, a 25-year. Jeez, man, that was good.
Yeah.
That would probably have to be that, I guess.
Absolutely. So Greg LeMond with a 25-year-old McLellan in Scotland feels like a pretty good answer. Look,
yeah, it'll be cool.
Grant, it's been amazing to have you on. I do a lot of these interviews with lots of different people about lots of different things. And
thank you.
We've never had anything like this. An extraordinary story of making the most of what sounds like an impossible chance to be given. And you've done so much with it. Thank you very much for interrupting your training schedule to have a sneaky little whiskey. And I wish you the very, very best of luck on your trip across Southern California. And hopefully, if we can make it work, we look forward to seeing you at the end of the trip in Irvine. So Grant Lottering, inspiration to many. Thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I love Scotch. 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 Yep.
And don't forget to not just follow us on Twitter and Instagram at US of Dramerica, but also ask us questions and comment and say nice things.
And please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if the mood takes you, you can leave us a review, as feedback is always welcome.
And drink whiskey. Sláinte.